Hello, and welcome to CR Amplified, the Cairo Reviews podcast where we talk to experts and policymakers about relevant issues on the world stage. I'm Abigail Flynn. Today, we'll be speaking about the ramifications of the U.S.-Israel war in Iran, particularly with regard to the members of the Axis of Resistance and the positions of the Gulf states, whose security relationship with the United States has been brought under question as these countries have been targeted during the current conflict by Iran. I am joined by Dr. Hamidreza Azizi, visiting fellow at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin and associate researcher at Klingendaal, the Netherlands Institute of International Relations. Dr. Azizi holds a PhD in regional studies from the University of Tehran, and his research focuses on security and geopolitical issues in the Middle East and Central Eurasia, Iran's foreign and security policy, and Iran-Russia relations. Dr. Azizi has also recently published a book, The Axis of Resistance, Iran, Israel, and the Struggle for the Middle East. He is joining us today to give his perspective on the current state of regional affairs. Dr. Azizi, thank you very much for joining us. Today, I wanted to get your opinion for our upcoming issue, which discusses the issue of power plays, particularly how smaller powers are handling the fact that these very large powers are coming head-to-head in many different ways, and most specifically, recently, with the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. So I wanted to get your perspective, starting with the Axis of Resistance. What players are currently still on the board? Where do they stand? And what's their position with regards to Iran at this point?
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to join you for this conversation. So, of course, the recent war, or in some way we can say the ongoing war between the U.S., Israel on one side and Iran on the other, has been also a kind of, test for the axis of resistance. Because what had emerged as some sort of a very solid bloc gathered around the Islamic Republic in Iran and by it since the October 7, 2023 went through a lot of ups and downs. There was a moment that, there seemed to be a sense of triumphalism, not just among the Iranian leaders, but, among other figures of the Axis like Hassan Nasrallah, others. But that was short-lived. Then came the blows to Hezbollah itself, the fall of Assad, and everything that eventually culminated in two wars, the 12-day war and the recent one. So one may ask, of course, credibly, where the Axis of Resistance stands in this whole thing. So let me start with a little bit of background from the 12-day war, where the Axis of Resistance was essentially absent, right? So at the time, this was interpreted primarily as the Axis basically losing its capacity, especially in this case, Hezbollah, and of course also Iran's allied Shia armed groups in Iraq, so none of which had any involvement in the war. And that had, that gave rise to this interpretation that this is actually the end of the Axis. And we know that actually what had worked as the main deterrent for Iran vis-a-vis Israel was probably not its own missiles and drones, but it was the presence of Hezbollah, also armed with Iran-made missiles and drones. And that was interpreted as basically, the kind of the weakening of Hezbollah as a very important condition that enabled the Israeli war on Iran in June 25. I was among the ones who argued at the time that there was more nuances, in this whole picture. And to me, the main reason why the Axis was rather inactive in the war was that the threat to the Islamic Republic, to the Iranian system on one side, and to the other members of the Axis on the other side was not existential yet. We did see, of course, already last June, a round of decapitations against senior Iranian officials. We did see the targeting of Iran's main nuclear facilities, but at the same time, it didn't amount to a sense within the Islamic Republic that you know, the system or the regime was on the verge of collapse. So was the idea or perception on the side of other members of the Axis, what is left of it, of course, which includes Hezbollah, you know, the more pro-Iran, let's say, camp within the Iraqi Shia militia landscape, and then also the Houthis. So that was the main reason. And of course, on the other side, and this is something that I can hear also argued by some Iran-based commentators, also close to the government, that the whole network, especially in this case Hezbollah, was at the time in the process of, you know, revival and kind of rethinking in terms of strategic orientation and also in terms of structure. So that wasn't still the right time. But this time it was different in many respects. On the one side, it appears that the process of restructuring of Hezbollah, especially in terms of its command and also in terms of the way of war, has rather reached a decisive point. The Hezbollah that we are seeing right now engaging with Israel in southern Lebanon and northern Israel is much different than what it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and under Nasrallah, let's say. It has, in a way, gone back to its roots in early 1980s, asymmetric warfare and so on. And Iran itself went through a significant kind of restructuring of its own command and control, decentralization of missile commands, etc., that we saw effectively enabling very rapid and, in a way, of course, effective response to American and Israeli attacks. That was also something that is the result of this whole period. And essentially, the sense of threat was kind of visible all around. And this has not just in terms of material elements, like the Islamic Republic, the Iranian regime being on the verge of collapse or not, which in some cases, the perception was that it was, as the kind of, you know, as a result of a combination of internal and external pressures. And that was why it, you know, went to the extreme in targeting not just the US bases, for example, and also Israeli targets, but also, you know, energy infrastructure in the region and all over. So that was the sense of existential anxiety. And on the side of allied groups like Hezbollah, like especially the Shia members in this case, the killing of Khamenei, Ali Khamenei, the Iranian supreme leader, was also seen as a as culmination point of what I see as a Shia anxiety, you know, someone who was not just a political leader of a country, but also had many followers in the Shia world being targeted. So these were the reasons why now we are seeing a kind of restructured axis, primarily centered on the Shia actors of it. Iran itself, the Iraqi Shia militias, and Hezbollah is now active. The Houthis seem to be on the reserve somehow, but it seems that there's a kind of a disconnection, at least at this point, between the Shia side of the Axis and the Palestinian groups like Hamas and others, who are now operating in a totally different environment in the post October 7th, you know, kind of reality.
Mm-hmm. I have a small follow-up for this question. As they are reviving with the focus on the Shia side of things, do you think
that these groups have the organizational capacity and the weaponry needed to be an effective fighting force within the Axis. Because we've seen, you know, over the past 3 years of war, a real like whittling down of these organizations. Do you think they have the ability to rebuild in this context?
Well, main question here would be how we define effectiveness in terms of, you know, kind of in the military sense of the word, of course. Because I think one reason that the Axis ended up in that sort of a paralysis or semi-paralysis state by the end of 2024, and I'm speaking, of course, of the erosion of Iran's own deterrence by that time as a result of tit for tat attacks with Israel, significant weakening of Hezbollah after the killing of its commanders, and especially Nasrallah himself, and also the fall of Assad. So one main reason for that was that the Axis had become too much maybe entrenched in politics and also economy of the host countries, that it somehow limited the military effectiveness of these groups, almost all of which had essentially been emerged in the initial phases as very small guerrilla groups, essentially operating in response to the either occupation or foreign invasion, in the case of, for example, the Iraqi armed groups or the Houthis, etc. So that meant that, for example, in the case of Lebanon, and again, this is something that I can hear clearly from the, let's say, pro-Axis experts and commentators, not just in Iran, also in other countries, when they speak about what went wrong regarding Hezbollah's deterrence also being eroded and, leading to the killing of its commanders. They speak about Hezbollah having just too much or too many considerations in joining the fight in support of Hamas, out of the fear that the war would spill over into Lebanon and would become destructive for the Lebanese society, which in the end happened. But Hezbollah's caution, somehow led step to a step and in an incremental way toward the same scenario, while essentially depriving Hezbollah from the capacity to use what it had. So in a very strange way, the fact that these groups, these members of the Axis now seem to have much less to lose, seems to have, resulted in more military effectiveness. And of course, here, the kind of innovative way of using technology, like what we are seeing, for example, in the case of Hezbollah using these FPV drones, and continued Iranian support contributes to this. So this restructuring means that they have now evolved into a bunch of, or better to say, a network. This is still a network of smaller groups, Iran itself, of course, excluded, the smaller groups, but in a sense, more agile, more asymmetric warfare oriented. And now, more in the sense of trying to impose costs on the adversaries rather than necessarily, or at least in this stage, shaping the dynamics of the countries where they are involved, because the constraints are real. So this is an adaptive process, I would say.
Okay. And now shifting slightly from the axis of resistance, I wanted to hear more of your thoughts on where the Gulf states are standing, because a lot of their relationship with the United States was based on a security guarantee. And now it seems that the United States has triggered a war that has resulted in a lot of destruction on the side of the Gulf states, calling into question, why did we cast our lot with the United States? Do you think that this will prompt a change in relationships? We've seen very recently the Financial Times report that is unconfirmed from the Saudi government about a potential Middle East non-aggression pact. What is your perspective on these types of movements with regard to where the Gulf states are going to be positioning themselves toward Iran?
Well, I think one of the other implications of the whole post-October 7 developments was that there is no such thing anymore like a Gulf position, you know, or a GCC position. You know, they at the political level, or rather publicly, they still try to show unity. The contacts still continue, but the rift is real, especially between two heavyweights, Saudi Arabia on one side and the UAE on the other side, because and this is something that I have also argued in, discussed actually in one of the chapters of my book, which is also titled The Axis of Resistance, that one of the kind of underlying issues that somehow was reflected in, but also impacted by, the October 7 developments and its aftermath was something that I call the clash of orders. So there has been like at least two diverging and competing views of regional order, one by Iran and the Axis of Resistance, and the other one by the U.S., by Israel and supported by the U.S. And the Gulf states for quite some time trying to position themselves somehow in between. But after that, and as a result of the sort of weakening, at least materially, of the Iranian vision, Gulf states have started to rethink and reposition themselves in this whole landscape. So on the one hand, we saw growing sort of a partnership between the UAE and Israel. So that was, of course, already the case with the Abraham Accords, but that went into some concrete steps, you know, that was somehow rather difficult to imagine before, given the concerns that the UAE, for example, and Bahrain on that matter had regarding Iran, like the IMAC corridor and UAE's eagerness to involve in it, and then also security cooperation, etc., etc. But at the same time, Saudi Arabia started to distance itself from what, you know, it would seem to be a kind of a more a convergent landscape, you know, of Arabs and Israel. So the normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel seems to be totally off the table at the moment. And there is a growing threat perception, not by the not just by the Saudis, also shared by some other heavyweights in the region, like Egypt, like Turkey, also supported by Qatar, that they are seeing now Israel also as a threat to regional security and also regional balance. So this is the shifting landscape that we are seeing right now. And that explains why, for example, already in this war and its aftermath, Saudi Arabia has been very much supportive of the Pakistani initiative to, you know, to push the U.S. and Iran toward a deal, but the UAE has a different view. So this is important to understand, and as a result of that, I think the October 7th aftermath and now the Iran war has kind of widened the gap between between these countries, and now the region is kind of being restructured in a way that conceptually is still dominated by the logical balance of power between different actors, but the poles in this kind of regional balancing has somehow shifted. So we still have Iran in a reconfigured way, especially if it comes out of this war with while establishing some credible control over the strait, and the very fact that it wasn't the regime was not destroyed, was not changed as a result of this war. So we still have the Iranian vision. We have a Saudi, Pakistani, Turkish view on the other side, and then we have the Emirati-Israeli axis. So these would be the main nodes, and other actors, like smaller actors, either in the Gulf or in other parts of the region, would somehow try to position themselves either as closer to one of these camps or somehow trying to balance between these different actors and different nodes.
Mm-hmm. So going along with that, what is Iran's primary goal at the moment? It seems that they have overcome the existential threat that the United States was originally wielding. So we've come down from that. The regime is still intact. If Iran could come out of this with a peak perfect regional alignment, what do you think that would look like? What are they trying to pursue?
Since the start of this war, Iran has pursued three kind of interconnected goals. So the primary goal was regime survival, and it still is. And the reason why I'm saying it still is, it's because, of course, the Islamic Republic managed to, kind of survive this war, let's say, and the new leadership seems to be pretty much in control. But economic difficulties, like the gap between the state and society, all these issues still remain. And that's one of the reasons, of course, the reason why they are now still in this process of diplomatic negotiations with the United States, because they need sanctions lifting, they need some economic dividends, as a result of a diplomatic track, in order to be able to effectively govern the country. So that's been the first objective. The second objective is the reestablishment of deterrence, in the sense that would guarantee that a war like this would not happen again. And that's one of the reasons, again, that we are hearing the Iranian position kind of emphasizing the need for guarantees, and also the control over the Strait of Hormuz as a leverage, or on that matter also the Iranian reluctance to ship their stockpile of highly enriched uranium outside as an upfront concession. So there's a kind of delicate positioning, delicate balance here that Iran is trying to preserve, to maintain, in the sense that they need to preserve enough leverage in order to make sure that a war like this, as I said, would not happen again. But it's not only related to that. It also has to do with trying to to impact the regional equation, especially around the Strait of Hormuz, by building on the gaps that I mentioned between different actors, like reaching out to Saudis while increasing pressure on the UAE and Bahrain, and at the same time trying to coordinate with Oman some sort of post-war arrangement of the Strait of Hormuz. And here comes the third objective, which is sort of a desire to change the regional equations, to redraw the lines of a geopolitical competition / cooperation, in the sense that Iran could reaffirm the position that was being weakened in the period between early 2024, especially from April 2024, let's say, when the first direct Israeli attack on Iranian position in Syria happened, up until this war. So these three objectives explain what Iran is doing at the moment, from reaching out, as I said, to some Gulf countries and trying to counterbalance different pressures from the region, to its position in the talks with the United States regarding nuclear and others. So this is the way that I can describe the landscape at the moment.
Understood. Well, that's all the questions that I had for you today. I do want to open the floor in case there was anything that you wish to talk about that I didn't cover so far.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of issues we can talk about, but I think the core issue here is that the recent U.S.-Israeli war on Iran has already started to have implications beyond the immediate kind of battlefield and beyond Iran. And this all has to do, I think, with the miscalculation on the side of the United States, especially in starting a war that they don't know how to end. But here, what's important is that even if the Islamic Republic and the United States managed to reach an agreement, and even if the proposal like the one that you mentioned reportedly raised by Saudi Arabia on establishing a regional framework like the Helsinki did in Europe, so even if all these go well, and there's an agreement bilaterally between U.S. and Iran, there's an agreement at the regional level, as long as the underlying hostility between Iran and Israel persists, I think it would be still too soon and too optimistic to speak about a stable regional setting, because both sides, both Iran and Israel, see this battle as existential now, even more than before. One could argue before this war that the sense of existential threat was more prominent on the Israeli side, because they were constantly under the threat of Iran's allies like Hamas, Hezbollah, etc. But now, after two wars, it is even more the case on the Iranian side. So this enmity, this hostility, I think, can manifest in different shapes and forms. For example, going back from the open to the shadows, to the gray zone. But this is not going to be solved anytime soon. And this remains as a central sort of a point of contention in the region, around which all those other dynamics that I mentioned are unfolding at the moment would be understood and developed.
I think you're very correct. The ramifications of this war are certainly going to be long-lasting. But I want to say thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today and to give us your very thoughtful perspectives. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again to Dr. Azizi for taking the time to speak with us today. And thanks to you, listener. We hope you enjoyed this episode of CR Amplified.